this is Deborah on Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for mid-October. This week, we are very pleased to have for you part two of an interview that we recorded a few weeks ago with Lucas Hart, the director of the Northwest Straits Commission. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a wonderful sound? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
Jeff Gibson has been finding joy in looking at the often overlooked coots at Cotai Nature Park. He wrote on the UW's Twitter site a few days ago, "Two American coots clambered up on the grassy shore near me and started eating little weed sprouts and stuff. They weren't moving around too much, plenty to eat. They gradually moved about 6 feet from me, about the closest distance my 8-power binoculars can focus. I love getting a real close-up view of things."
First, I admired the shield, that knob at the base of the bill, which glowed like polished mahogany. I've never noticed it quite so well before. Of course, there were the red eyes, white bill with its little dark mark, the black feathers, all well-known coot features.
"At such a close range, I really couldn't see all the birds at once, just parts. It was then that I noticed some strange leaves under the coot. It was some marsh plant I'd never seen before, with banded palmate leaves. I then realized it wasn't a plant. It was the coot's feet." Coots have really cool feet, quite large for the size of the bird, and flat as a crepe, so it's easy to mistake for vegetation.
In case you've never checked out coot feet before, you really should. They're quite remarkable and serve these birds as perfect paddles for moving about the lake. Our thanks to Jeff for reminding us to look carefully at things that may at first glance seem common in the natural world around us, and to the Twitter site for the posting.
In other birding news, John Gatchett posted on eBird that he saw a group of 350 Pacific loons in Squim Bay last Sunday, which is a huge congregation for loons. These are likely part of a migrating flock. Pacific loons breed in the high Arctic in winter all along the Pacific coast from Alaska to the Sea of Cortez.
We were over visiting our neighbor Donald Robinson last week when he warned us about a yellowjacket nest in his field. We went to look at it and just found a large hole in the ground with a few insects left wandering about the base of it. It looked like it had been dug up by a raccoon, who find the nests a delicacy, waiting until fall to dig the nests out when the cold nighttime temperatures slow the yellowjackets down and the comb is full of succulent larvae.
Yellowjackets make paper nests and either hang them from trees or the eaves of your house, or construct them underground. The ground nesting ones can be very difficult to spot and avoid, as they often consist of just a small wasp-sized opening, but can house thousands of wasps working underneath the surface. By this time of year, the adults will be dying off, however, just leaving the queen and larva to overwinter and emerge in the spring to fly off elsewhere.
And now on to part two of our interview with Lucas Hart. Last month, we got so caught up in one of my current fascinations, forage fish, that we never got to talk about all the other cool projects that you and the Northwest Straits Commission are involved with, Lucas. So would you like to start by speaking about the Olympia Oyster Restoration Project? And before that, I guess we need like a short primer on what an Olympia oyster is and why it needs to be restored in the first place.
Yeah, the Olympia oysters are actually the only native oyster to Puget Sound. A lot of people are familiar with Pacific oysters. They're actually imported from Japan. They tend to grow bigger and faster than Olympia oysters. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, Olympia oysters were nearly extirpated from Puget Sound due to overharvest and pollution. And it's one of those native species that plays a pretty important role in terms of water quality. It also helps create some kind of lower level three-dimensional habitat, not to the extent that Pacific oyster reefs would create, but it is important for those reasons. And we've started getting involved in Olympia oyster restoration quite some time ago. Marine Resources Committees became interested in it. And it's another one of those projects where you have volunteers out in the mud flats helping to restore these species. And I think it's probably one of the most successful projects in terms of restoration that we can point to in Puget Sound. We're actually starting to see some natural spawn happening in many areas. And some have said that there's some very small Olympia oyster reef starting to reform as well. Granted, you know, it's going to be probably decades before we really know how successful this is and whether they can ever reach the level that they were 100 or more years ago. But it's very promising and has been a really kind of exciting project to watch.
Do the Pacific oysters compete actively with the Olympia oysters, or is the habitat slightly different so that they can exist or coexist?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think there's a lot of direct competition there. In fact, a lot of the restoration work that we do uses Pacific oyster shell as a substrate. So you can either put Pacific oyster shell out and Olympia oysters will settle on that shell and grow. You can grow Olympia oysters on Pacific oysters in a laboratory setting and then outplant those in a natural environment. So they can coexist, is what I'm getting at. And so I think having Pacific oysters around is, in some degree, has been important for that restoration work.
Yeah. Well, I actually went to a great beach survey class last Sunday at the USGS Research Station out on Maristone, which, by the way, was sponsored by the Jefferson County Marine Resources Committee and made possible by a grant that you guys partnered in securing. So it was a great class, and I learned a lot. And one of the things that I learned was that Olympia oysters mature a lot more slowly than the exotic Pacific oysters, and they can therefore tolerate higher acid concentrations, which should help them survive conditions of ocean acidification. So speaking of ocean acidification, I know that you also have a project addressing this critical problem in our area, right?
Yeah. The Northwest Straits Commission has done some public workshops on ocean acidification to educate people about the issue. And ocean acidification, if people aren't aware, is related to climate change. It's one of the issues that people kind of overlook. You don't hear quite as much about. And the reason it happens is because when you put excess carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the ocean is really important for taking up some of that excess carbon dioxide, and it actually absorbs about 25% of the CO2. And when it gets in the water, it creates carbonic acid. And carbonic acid then, to talk about it kind of simplistically, it steals carbonate from the water. And carbonate is really important for shelled organisms like oysters to create their shells. And the neat thing about Olympia oysters is that it appears as if they create their shell very slowly. So they don't expend a lot of energy to create the shell up front when they're younger, whereas Pacific oysters use a lot of energy to create a shell really fast when they're young. So if you have less carbonate in the water, they have to expend a lot of energy to try to capture that carbonate. And that doesn't leave a lot of energy left for other functions like metabolism later in life. So that can then lead to death. Whereas with Olympia oysters, they kind of take their time and use energy for other things and develop. And eventually they get their shell built and they have enough energy for other important survival functions.
Huh. That's an interesting way of looking at it. Are you like monitoring the levels of acid in the ocean? I mean, is that another of the citizen science projects that you have going?
We're not directly involved in that. It's actually kind of a complicated methodology for measuring acidification. There is a program called the Acidification Nearshore Monitoring Network, or ANEMONE for short, that the Department of Natural Resources has going on. And there are volunteers involved in that project. We've talked about joining it, and maybe one day we will be part of it. But right now, we're not directly involved in monitoring ocean chemistry.
Well, you guys have so many other things going on. I mean, at the end of the program, we'll tell people to go look at the website. But the website is amazing. I mean, there's just a lot that you guys are involved with. So you really have to decide where to focus your energies, because there's a lot going on in the marine environment that needs attention.
That's a fact.
Yes. And speaking of which, there are conspicuous declines in the abundance of bull kelp being the most common canopy-forming species of kelp in Puget Sound. And these declines have been observed in many areas. Why do scientists think that this is happening?
Yeah, that is kind of an emerging issue. And I wish there was a simple answer to that question. That it looks like it could be a variety of different factors. Water temperature seems to be one of the biggest impacts to kelp. There's kind of an optimal range where they're able to survive and thrive. When you get outside that range, kelp tends to die. Development on the shorelines has been another impact, which can lead to sedimentation. And when you get excess sediment in the water, that can cover the habitat that kelp requires to grow successfully. So those are two of the big impacts. And water mixing is something that's been kind of interesting to think about in relation to kelp declines as well. If you look in areas where we don't get quite as much mixing in Puget Sound, like South Sound, you tend to see more kelp loss. And in South Sound especially, I think there's areas there where kelp has disappeared. Over 90% of the population has disappeared. In other areas where there's more mixing, for example, as the Strait of Juan de Fuca enters Puget Sound and kind of on the west side of Whidbey Island, in those areas, you don't see as much change in kelp. So that would tell us that there's something with that mixing process, for example, maybe temperature.
And I mean, there could be all kinds of things going on. I mean, temperature and, you know, all kinds of nutrients there. Yep. And then also the fact that the sediment, if there's not mixing, would tend to kind of drown the system.
Sure. Yeah. Like I mentioned, it's a really complicated process that we don't completely understand yet. But I think as we continue to look more deeply at it, I'm pretty confident scientists are going to get a pretty good handle on what's happening there.
And you have another ongoing project to monitor bull kelp abundance and promote recovery, right?
Yeah, we have a volunteer kayak-based kelp monitoring project.
Oh, that probably gets a lot of volunteers,
but probably
just like in the summer.
Yeah, you're right on. That's exactly right.
But that's probably when you most need it, when they're growing the most.
Generally, June through September is when kelp tends to grow, and that's when we have our kayak monitoring happening. Volunteers use a handheld GPS. They paddle around the kelp beds, and that gives us the ability to create a GIS map and track it over time. I think we're in our fifth year of this project. I mentioned earlier how important it is to track these things for long periods to get a sense of trends. And there's a lot of kelp that hasn't been monitored in Puget Sound. The Department of Natural Resources has done the best they can to track it. And we are working with them very closely on this project. They've been a great partner. And we're hoping that we can help contribute some new data to how kelp is changing in Puget Sound based on these volunteer data sets.
Oh, that's great. So you've also worked with NOAA a bit on that, right? And they're focusing on rockfish recovery. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they were a partner actually in creating the kayak-based kelp monitoring protocol that I mentioned. And they also published their rockfish recovery plan in 2017. And in that plan, kelp is mentioned as a critical or as a component of critical habitat for rockfish. And as such, we have to do something to protect those habitats or restore them. So they provided funding to do a kelp conservation and recovery plan. We're in our second year of that. The Northwest Straits Commission is leading it. We have numerous partners, including NOAA, on this project. We're hoping that it'll be done in late this year, probably December-ish. And what that plan is going to do is kind of outline some of the data gaps that we have and help help us focus some of our attention on the most important things that we have to understand related to kelp in order to help restore and protect it.
Uh-huh. And then you have the derelict fishing gear recovery program, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that one goes back quite some time, too, to the early 2000s, I believe. That was before my time with the commission. But it started out as a derelict net recovery program. And the reason that that's important is when you lose derelict, or when you lose gear and it becomes derelict, it tends to ghost fish. So organisms can get caught up in that gear and they eventually die. So that program went on until, I believe, around 2010, and thousands of derelict nets were removed from Puget Sound. The program has been picked up by the Northwest Straits Foundation, and it's sort of evolved to focus more on derelict crab pots now.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same concept. When you lose a derelict crab pot, it's going to continue to fish.
Well, yeah. And I was reading on your website that, I mean, it's an astounding number of crabs, of viable crabs that they figure they lose every year that drowned in these traps, right? I mean, it's like 180,000. I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's not just a couple hundred. It's, you know, almost 200,000 crab.
And it's about 12,000 crab pots that are lost every year in Puget Sound. Yeah.
That happens for all kinds of reasons, right? Mm-hmm. You know, lines break, storms come up.
Yeah. That's one of the components of that project is something that we've called our Catch More Crab project. And it's the education component of the crab pot removal program, where crabbers are educated on sustainable harvest techniques. So things like using rot cord on the escape hatch of the trap. So if you do lose it, the rot cord disappears, the hatch opens and crabs can get out.
Mm-hmm.
Things like using enough line on your buoy so you can find your pot, watching tides and currents so that your pots aren't washed away, keeping pots out of shipping lanes, things like that are really important, can help a lot with reducing crab pot loss.
Mm-hmm. You do a lot of outreach and education and stewardship programs, right?
Yeah. Catch More Crab is one of them. There's another really cool one right here in Jefferson County that takes individuals out to learn about sustainable shellfish harvest, clams and oysters primarily. And
it's called Digging for Dinner,
Digging
right?
Digging for Dinner, yeah.
Sorry I missed that one. When I took my other class Sunday, they mentioned that this was kind of the companion to Digging for Dinner. And I was like, oh, darn, I would have really liked to have gone to that one.
It's really popular. And it fills up every time they hold it. That's through Jefferson Marine Resources Committee. And it also has a water quality component to it. Department of Fish and Wildlife comes out and talks about regulations and things like that. It's really popular and a really neat program that I'd like to see expanded. We also have programs like Salish Sea Stewards in Skagit County and North Sound Stewards in Whatcom County. And those are aimed at bringing potential volunteers in to teach them about various opportunities that exist for volunteering. And it also is a really good opportunity to teach people about Puget Sound ecosystem. And in return, after going through the class, people that attend dedicate so many hours towards volunteering to a project of their choice that they've learned about through the program. So those are a couple of other examples.
Uh-huh. Well, because most people that live here really love it here and they want to give back. So they just, and they want to do good. So it's good to be able to, you know, teach them about what they can do to improve the environment and hopefully plug into one of these great opportunities. Where do you most need people right now?
I think, you know, I leave that up to the individual. I want people to get involved in things that really resonates with them, because that's really where people are going to be able to stick around. If you try to force people into a box, I think you're at risk of people losing interest. But what I would encourage people to do, and I think this is always the first step, is really educate themselves about what's happening in Puget Sound. That's the first thing you have to do, because when we look out the window, we see a really beautiful environment. People want to live here. because it is a great place to live. There's a lot of things happening in Puget Sound that are making it unhealthy.
And well, and just the fact that people love it so much, they want to come live here. And just the fact that there are more people ends up, you know, undermining the whole ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's a behavior change. So I think it starts with education. So if people take the initiative to educate themselves about the environment here and change their behaviors accordingly, I think that is a really great first step. And then we've been talking a lot about volunteer opportunities, getting involved with some of these projects and going out and getting their hands dirty. Take your pick. There's lots of projects to get involved with, and it's a good way to help out.
Yeah, there are. And speaking of which, we should give people the website so that they can go look and explore and figure out how they'd like to plug in.
Yeah.
And that's northweststraits.org. Is that the best place to find you?
Yeah. They can find us there.
And then contact whoever is in charge of a specific project or stewardship opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. We'd be happy to talk to anybody that's interested in getting involved or just to talk about Puget Sound.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. And we really enjoyed getting this little sampler of what you guys do. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. And thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, it's a pleasure. After we recorded our interview, Lucas wanted to be certain that we acknowledged the fact that the Northwest Straits Foundation is a vital partner with them in the kelp recovery and monitoring work that we mentioned in our program. We also wanted to be sure that folks got the correct spelling for the Commission's website. Please go to northweststraits.org, but spelled N-W Straits, STRAITS.org, to find out more about their great work. And there are some great upcoming natural history events to tell you about this week. The Olympic Peninsula chapter of the Audubon Society has a couple of fine events planned. The first, their monthly meeting, featuring a presentation on birding the ancient forests in El Triunfo Biosphere Reserve in Chiapas, Mexico. Join them at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, October 16th at the Dungeness River Audubon Center just outside of Squim. Then on Saturday, October 19th, there's another presentation at the center from 10 to noon on weasels, otters, and their cousins. Go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more details.
The Port Townsend chapter of the Audubon Society, Admiralty Audubon, has its own fine set of events, starting with their monthly meeting on Thursday, October 17th. Come hear about wildlife adventures in Costa Rica at the Port Townsend Community Center starting at 7 p.m. Then on Sunday, October 20th, join them for a work party from 9 a.m. to noon at the Katai Nature Park. Please go to admiraltyaudubon.org for more details on either of these events.
Lastly, if you listened to Nan's interesting show last week on our native corals and current studies on ocean acidification, you will be especially keen to hear the whole lecture, sponsored by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. Come to the Fort Worden Chapel at 3 p.m. this Sunday, October 20th, or go to ptmsc.org for more information. And here's our mystery sound again. This week's mystery sounds are cool variations on the more usual feeding calls from bubble netting humpback whales. These sounds were recorded under NOAA permit by Fred Sharp and his colleagues with the Alaska Whale Foundation, who have been studying humpback whales for decades up in southeast Alaska. The whales make an amazing variety of sounds, but their function remains largely a mystery. Similar to human social jabber, they may reveal individual identity, intensity of emotions, or represent negotiation about adoption of specialized tasks within the bubble netting team. We have been very fortunate to see the humpback population recovering here in the Salish Sea and throughout most of the world's oceans. Lately, humpbacks have been spotted from the Edmonds Kingston Ferry and around Possession Point on Whidbey Island. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the week of October 16th. Thanks to all of you for listening. Closing music is Meisterseat from the album Grooved Whale by Lisa Walker, incorporating some calls from humpback whales up in southeast Alaska. As always, happy trails.